Words are inherently empty, and yet still I am fond of brush and ink. My mind like ashes after the fire, and yet still I am tied to the world. So I, in the last period, was reflecting a little bit on what I was going to talk about, and I thought I would call this talk Compassion for Delusions. And I love that beautiful poem that we just read, written by one of the women, a few women actually, who have made it into our current sutra book, although that is shortly changing when we will have our new sutra book, which includes more female authors. But that notion of yes, there is a kind of purity in our practice, that we can discover a samadhi of practice, a sense of oneness with the vastness of the landscape of our lives. And yet still, I am fond of brush and ink. Still, I'm fond of words and language and thoughts that come. I am tied to this world. Still, I find myself caring about things. Not the hermit monk lost in the hut. Different voice here, one of the bodhisattva. That chant, paired with the previous one, the one before, on purifying, right, grinding away until we touch into the kind of pure awareness of our being, emptiness, sometimes described that way. You know, those two chants, they go hand in hand in a way. They seem contradictory. But for me, this practice of sitting is really one of integration. So I have a story I want to read to you. I mentioned before that I was reading this book called Thousand Peaks. It's about Korean Zen, which is one of the tributary streams of our lineage. And I've mentioned before, but David Reinick, having received a transmission from Sung San, or well, George Bowman, and then George Bowman from Sung San, who brought the Korean practice to the United States. So I've found myself quite curious, since this is one of the streams of our lineage, to learn more about this Korean practice. And one does find a slightly different emphasis, or I should say at least a little bit more of a willingness to acknowledge a kind of samadhi practice that we don't talk too much about in Boundless Way Zen. And there are shadows to talking about samadhi, shadows to talking about this idea of the silencing of thought, in which one can often find a kind of just purity, a kind of openness. Because, you know, one of the shadows is that we get very attached to it. And, of course, life cannot manifest this way. There's a wonderful koan where all the Buddhas cannot awaken a practitioner from a deep, deep samadhi. She's in a deep samadhi, and, you know, Buddhas are called up and bodhisattvas are called up, and none of them can awaken her and engage her in life again. And they have to call up the bodhisattva of great delusion, who comes out of hell, snaps his fingers, and immediately she's awake. So we actually, in some way, need our delusions to exist in this world. So here's a story that I think helps illustrate this. This kind of practice where we can both awaken to a purity, to a samadhi, cultivate some capacity with prajna, with the sword of wisdom that recognizes delusion as delusion, but also that does not abandon the heart of compassion, the heart of care. There's a story of a teacher in the lineage tradition, the Korean lineage tradition here. I want to tell you about Won Hyo. One evening, as Won Hyo was crossing the desert, he stopped at a small patch of green where there were few trees and some water and went to sleep. Toward midnight, he awoke thirsty. It was pitch dark. He groped along on all fours, searching for water. At last, his hand touched a cup on the ground. He picked it up and drank. Ah, how delicious. Then he bowed deeply in gratitude to Buddha for the gift of water. The next morning, when Won Hyo woke, he saw beside him what he had taken for a cup during the night. It was a shattered skull, blood caked, and with shreds of flesh still stuck to the cheekbones. Strange insects crawled or floated on the surface of the filthy rainwater inside it. Won Hyo looked at the skull and felt a great wave of nausea. He opened his mouth. As soon as the vomit poured out, his mind opened and he understood. Last night, since he hadn't seen and hadn't thought, the water was delicious. This morning, seeing and thinking had made him vomit. Ah, he said to himself, thinking makes good and bad, life and death. Without thinking, there is no universe, no Buddha, no Dharma. All is one, and this one is empty. There was no need now to find a master. Won Hyo already understood life and death. What more was there to learn? So he turned and started back across the desert to Korea. He was on his way to China to find a great teacher, and instead he found a skull. And the skull taught him about thinking. So this is no small insight that Won Hyo has had here. Of course, what follows it is a kind of arrogance and a sense of, oh, now I've got it all figured out. And he doesn't at all. But he has had a taste of awakening here. He suddenly recognized thoughts as thoughts, rather than seeing them as reality in and of itself, life and death, simply as ideas. Good and bad, right and wrong, are most dearly held delusions. He saw them simply as thoughts. This was profoundly liberating. You have probably had this experience before. There is great power in seeing mind states as mind states, in seeing thoughts as thoughts. Sometimes just naming them is enough. It's a skillful means. The other day, I was feeling terribly ashamed about something that was happening in my family life related to my son, parenting issue. And I felt like a horrible father. And so I got on my phone between classes, and I texted a good friend, and I said, I'm so ashamed right now. So powerful to simply name what has arisen as a mind state and recognize it as a mind state. There's a kind of liberation in that. It's hard to describe, but when you're sitting on the cushion and you can do nothing about it, Sometimes when you recognize a mind state as a mind state, you realize that it's not reality. It's something that has arisen as a set of thoughts and feelings that have taken possession of the heart-mind, that have created a kind of small world for us. Sometimes naming that is enough. It just begins to evolve. Just noticing, just paying attention, everything goes its own way. Everything is intrinsically impermanent, empty, without fixed nature. And everything exists in the fabric of the whole universe. When we name these claustrophobic mind states, sometimes they just open up and we see this is a mind state. Sometimes they evaporate, like what happened here to our ancestor. The mind state utterly evaporated. Great clarity. Suddenly, pure presence. The skull neither good or bad, just the sound of water. This is liberating. This is the liberating truth that he woke to in that moment. The falling away of mind and body, the falling away of differentiation, the falling away of good and bad, sometimes described as the true nature of what's here, a kind of existence before thought. Now, of course, to get stuck to this mind state, it's just another mind state, is a hell cave. Nothing can happen from this place. We are of no service to the world. It is, of course, quite compelling. There is a part of me that has the mountain monk in him, the hermit, the one who wants to go find a cave in the mountains in Korea. Just like so many of these teachers did, to go tuck myself away and practice in nature. No more worrying about the struggles of society. This is just, the recluse. This is, in a sense, the practice of the arhat, the traditional. One might argue the first practices in Buddhism were arhat practices. Practices not concerned with saving all beings or re-engaging in the world, simply concerned with one's own personal liberation. Awakening to the true nature of reality is a kind of liberation. When we taste it, we feel that freedom. We may find ourselves feeling somewhat attached to it. And so, abandon the search for a teacher. Abandon care about the suffering in the world as we simply want to give it up. And so our teacher goes on. After his return to Silla, Juan Hyo's activities became more and more unorthodox. And the following encounter happened to him. There was a very famous monk in Silla, a little old man with a wisp of beard and skin like a crumpled paper bag. Barefoot and in tattered clothes, he walked through the town, ringing his bell, calling, "Dayon, Dayon, Dayon." It means great peace. Dayon also happens to be David Reinick's given Buddhist name. Great peace. Dayon, don't think. Dayon, like this. Dayon, rest mine. Dayon, Dayon, he called. Wan Yo heard of him and one day hiked to the mountain cave where the monk lived. From a distance, he could hear the sound of extraordinarily lovely chanting echoing through the valleys. But when he arrived at the cave, he found the master sitting beside a dead fawn, weeping. Wan Hyo was dumbfounded. How could an enlightened being be either happy or sad? Since in the state of nirvana, there is nothing to be happy or sad about, and no one to be happy or sad. He stood speechless for a while, and then asked the master why he was weeping. The master explained he had come upon the fawn after its mother had been killed by hunters. It was very hungry, so he had gone into town and begged for milk. Since he knew that no one would give milk for an animal, he said it was for his son. A monk with a son, what a dirty old man, people thought. But someone gave him a little milk. He had continued this way for a month, begging enough to keep the animal alive. Then the scandal became too great and no one would help. He had been wandering for 3 days now in search of milk. At last he had found some, but when he had returned to his cave, the fawn was already dead. You don't understand, said the master. My mind and the fawn's mind are the same. It was very hungry. I want milk. I want milk. Now it is dead. Its mind is my mind. That is why I am weeping. I want milk. Wan Yo began to understand how great a bodhisattva the master was. When all creatures were happy, he was happy. When all creatures were sad, he was sad. Wan Yo said to him, please teach me. I find that to be a very moving story. Wan Hyo, open enough to see that this great compassionate heart was also awakening, a manifestation of non-duality, that love and care and the suffering that accompany love and care are also a manifestation of the Dharma. A manifestation of non-duality, a manifestation of emptiness. Even this mountain monk off in the mountains, filled with love and care, not filled with samadhi alone. This is indeed actually a kind of ripening of samadhi. A samadhi without bounds, a samadhi without definition. Not simply the samadhi of attachment to peace, the samadhi of oneness with all beings. The samadhi of being attached to this world, because we are attached to this world. We are this world. We do not exist separately. Our hearts and minds are literally made up of this world. Sometimes what is manifests as great peace. Dayan. Sometimes what manifests is great sorrow, is great care, is great delusion. Our practice is not to attain a particular state of mind and reside in it permanently. Our practice is to keep turning toward whatever is. When we have moments of great peace, we can appreciate and celebrate the vastness, the great emptiness of our being. Sometimes what appears to us instead is great care, great love, great pain. And in those moments, that too is emptiness. This too is the presence of non-duality, of awakening, of our interwoven nature, impermanent, and yet manifesting. Our job is not to find any fixed place, but to continue turning toward whatever is, with an open heart. In this way, we will find ourselves sometimes called to a practice of peace. Sometimes we need that peace. We need to find places in our lives where we can recover our strength, be in touch with that part of ourselves that is just nurtured and fed by the simple presence of the sound of heat pulsing through a building. To just receive those moments when they come with great gratitude. And sometimes the world needs us. It needs us to give back, nurtured from our practice, called by the world. We get off the cushion and go begging for milk. Whatever little thing we can do.